Coming up, it's Philosophy Talk.
Vaccines cause autism?
Well, I have 1 million results that say they don't, and one result that says they do.
I knew it.
If humans are so rational, then how come we suffer from so many cognitive biases?
Is knowing that you have certain cognitive biases enough to counteract their influences on your thinking?
I'm not biased, you're biased.
He's a man with a plan. Got a counterfeit dollar in his hand. He's Mr. Know-It-All.
So she doesn't like me?
No.
She said that?
Yes.
She told you she doesn't like me?
Yes.
What were her exact words?
I don't like him.
Our guest is University of Virginia psychologist Brian Nosek.
Cognitive Bias, coming up on Philosophy Talk. Why are our minds so full of cognitive biases?
Is there any hope of overcoming them?
Or are they hopelessly beyond our control?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm Deborah Satz, sitting in for John Perry.
We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where both Ken and I teach philosophy.
Well, Deborah, you've been a frequent guest on the show, but it's great to have you joining me behind the mic, so to speak.
It's always great to be here, Ken.
Now, today, we're asking about cognitive bias. It's another episode in our ongoing series on intellectual humility.
Aristotle defined humans as rational animals, but he was wrong. The human mind is riddled with cognitive biases.
I'll say, Deborah, didn't you know? I looked this up the other day. There are like 150 named cognitive biases. There's confirmation bias, in-group bias, loss aversion, the halo effect, endowment effects, and then there's something called the IKEA effect of all things.
And every time you turn around, some clever psychologist is naming yet another one.
Well, whatever you name them, cognitive biases certainly suck. They distort gender relations, racial relations, employment, education, our self-images, politics. They even distort science.
And you know what? We're mostly not even aware of them. That makes them really hard to correct.
Here's an example that always bothers me. Take a group of teachers, divide them into two random groups. Give each group the exact same set of papers to grade, exact same papers, Deborah, but put African-American-sounding names on the one set and Anglo-sounding names on the other. I bet you know the punchline here, right?
Yeah, I do, unfortunately. African-American-sounding names get lower grades than the Anglo-sounding names.
That's why I had such problems back in school. No, but what should we conclude about this? I mean, should we conclude that teachers are just bigots?
But you know what? We all do it. Black, white, male, female, liberal, conservative, it doesn't matter.
Well, okay, so maybe teachers just need to try harder. They need to focus on the quality of the paper and block out all these extraneous factors.
The ironic thing is that trying can actually make it worse, and that's because it biases you to thinking you've succeeded. It's like you go, hey, I've no more bias, and then you go, this is what I think, and I'm not biased, so it must be true.
Oh, goodness. So I bet you're going to tell me that there's some clever name for this one, too.
Of course. It's called the I think it, therefore it's true effect.
Okay. So look, what should we just conclude we're doomed to cognitive bias?
Well, we certainly can't just will our biases away.
Well, okay, but what about education and training? That's got to help.
You'd be surprised. Even highly educated and trained scientists still suffer from cognitive biases. And even we, the ever so rational philosophers, have our biases.
Oh, yeah, no, that's a depressing thought. So look, it seems to me that suggests that the mind is just a junkyard. Is that what we're saying here?
No, the mind's not a junkyard. It was designed by evolution. And evolution doesn't do junk. Evolution does beneficial adaptations.
But cognitive biases, they're not beneficial. They're useless.
Well, they probably were very beneficial at one point. On the savannah, if you took time to consider things from all angles, you probably wouldn't survive. So natural selection designed our brains to make quick and dirty decisions on the fly. Now, granted, these decisions didn't always yield the truth, but they help keep our ancestors alive. So our cognitive biases are features rather than simply bugs.
Maybe once upon a time. But you know what, Deborah, we're not on the savannah anymore. Click your heels and make all these quick and dirty decisions go away. It won't cut it in the modern world. You know, to thrive in the modern world, we need to de-bias our minds.
Good luck with that.
Well, I'm not sure it's as hard as you're making it out to be. I mean, because take those teachers. Here's an idea. They can just de-bias just by doing what we do in academic journals, anonymize student papers. It doesn't take Herculean effort. It doesn't take a lot of education. It's easy.
Okay, I grant in that case, we can deal with it. But to think that there'll always be an easy fix like that is just an example of the optimism bias at work.
God, optimism bias. Can we stop with the cute names already? Look, I don't think I'm suffering from optimism bias. I really don't. I'm suggesting that, okay, maybe we just take our biases one by one, kind of think about them piecemeal, and develop sort of local strategies for overcoming them. Who could object to that?
Maybe you have a point here. And to help us strategize about overcoming our biases, our roving philosophical reporter, Holly McDeed, has prepared a little primer on the variety of cognitive biases. She files this report.
When I was a kid, I tried selling acorn necklaces in my middle school cafeteria. As in, necklaces I made out of acorns. As in, acorns I found in my backyard. I thought they were worth at least 10 bucks. And I was astonished when my business did not take off. Turns out, researchers have an explanation for why I came to believe these acorn necklaces were worth so much.
People tend to value something that they've created more than an identical product created by someone else.
Daniel Mochon, a professor at Tulane University, says people also overvalue products they helped make.
Say I built a table and it came out a little bit crooked. To me, it might be the most beautiful thing in the world because I made it.
Mochon calls this cognitive bias the IKEA effect. To test this theory, Mochon had participants in a study make and build things, like origami, Lego sets, and, of course, IKEA furniture. He published the results in a study called When Labor Leads to Love.
And what we found is that people tended to be willing to pay more money for the exact same product when they had built it than when someone else had built it. The fact that you imbue the product you created with a value, it's sort of a signal of your own competence and your own self.
There's similar cognitive biases, like the endowment effect. That's when people value something more because they own it. Another bias says people value something more the harder they work for it.
One of the ways in which cults try to brainwash people is by putting a lot of effort into joining and being part of it.
Then again, researchers have biases themselves. There's something called a confirmation bias that says our minds reject information we don't agree with. There's a similar bias called implicit egotism that says people love what's familiar. So people with the last name Carpenter are slightly more likely to become carpenters. People who share the same birthday are slightly more likely to get married to one another. My favorite cognitive bias, though, is the rhyme as reason effect, which says that if something rhymes, we're more likely to believe it. In a study, Matthew McGlone, a professor at the University of Texas at Austin, asked participants to identify statements they thought were true. Participants were more likely to say that the rhyming statements were accurate.
So they found what sobriety conceals, alcohol reveals, to be more truthful than what sobriety conceals, alcohol unmasks.
Like a lot of cognitive biases, McGlone says the rhyme as reason effect has helped humans survive. It's evolution.
The ease with which we process information is something that our brains have evolved to equate with familiarity.
If something feels familiar, it means it hasn't eaten us yet. But cognitive biases can also cloud our judgment in more serious ways. For example, what if a rhyme could help decide a court case? Remember this famous one?
O.J. Simpson, in a knit cap from two blocks away, is still O.J. Simpson. It's no disguise. It's no disguise. It makes no sense. It doesn't fit. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
A paraphrase of it says, if the glove doesn't fit, you must find him not guilty. That doesn't seem to make a whole hell of a lot of sense in and of itself. By virtue of packaging it in this pleasant-sounding rhyming form, it takes some pretty suspicious reasoning and makes it that much more compelling.
It might seem scary to think that so many of our choices aren't the result of rational judgment. So, are we responsible for any of our own beliefs? McGlone says, when people are paying attention, some cognitive biases, like the rhyme is reason effect, stop working. But
when we're compromised in terms of our attention or our energy level, it might be something that we really have to worry about.
So maybe the problem with my acorn necklaces wasn't that they weren't great. Maybe it's just that there's not a whole lot of words that rhyme with acorn or with necklace to convince otherwise unwilling buyers to hand over 10 bucks. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly Timmick-Teed.
Thanks, Holly, for that fascinating tour of the junkyard that is the human brain. I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, Deborah Satz, and today we're asking about cognitive bias.
We're joined now by Brian Nosek, professor of psychology at the University of Virginia, where he's also the co-founder and director of the Center for Open Science. Brian, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks for having me.
So, Brian, so what first drew you to this topic of cognitive bias? Was it an attempt to overcome your own, perhaps, or was it a way of coping with all the biases of all the people around you?
It was an observation of both, which was just that sense of we make assumptions of each other based on gender or race or age all of the time, and often in ways that are surprising or not intended. So I was a student taking computer science classes and women's studies classes at the same time, and just the experience of being in those two classrooms and the different assumptions that people made about me as a male in those classrooms and about others as men or women in those classrooms sort of was stunning, in sort of that revelation of, do we even know that we're doing this? Are we even aware that we are using some background assumptions that we may not even believe about what men and women are like to decide how to interact with men and women?
Great. Well, as Ken said in the opening, researchers have discovered lots of cognitive biases. I think the number is approaching 200. And I'm wondering, are they really uncovering different manifestations of a few underlying biases and just giving each manifestation a different name? Do we really have so many biases?
It's hard to say. I think it's more the former, that we are giving lots of names to things that are slightly different. And the reason that I think that is that there's probably a smaller set of ways in which the mind works, makes assumptions, right? Familiarity came up in one of the earlier examples. And that sense of familiarity leading to liking, leading to believing, probably underlies a number of different biases that end up with different names. But they end up with different names for a couple of reasons. One is that the ways in which these things manifest can be quite different. And another is that it's hard to tell if it's based on the same processes of the mind, because we can't really figure out what the processes of the mind are very easily.
So I'm just curious then, you know, maybe there's bias in the finding of all these biases, and there's a lot of incentives for scientists to name new biases. Right. So I noticed some of the biases are named after the scientists themselves.
Right. You didn't bring up the Nosek bias. I was quite disappointed, although it hasn't been discovered yet. I'm still trying. There are lots of incentives for researchers to name biases new things, because part of the way in which the system works for discovering things in science is to make a mark of having found something new. If I find a bias and it's a lot like the bias that you found, well, I could say, oh, I found what you found. And everybody says, well, that's great. She already found it. If I instead say, oh, I found this new thing and it's called this, then people might pay more attention.
Well, this is very fascinating, Brian, and we're going to have to dig in to what really makes for a cognitive bias, but we'll do that in our next segment. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about cognitive bias with Brian Nosek from the University of Virginia.
In our next segment, we'll dig deeper into the nature of cognitive biases. Where do our biases come from? How do they influence perception, reasoning, and decision-making? Do they help or hinder the mind?
Cognitive bias, feature, bug, or both? When Philosophy Talk continues.
Cognitive bias, your mind becomes blinded. Decisions and problems, you've been forced to solve them wrongly.
If we humans are the so-called rational animal, as Aristotle insisted, why do we have so many cognitive biases? I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Deborah Satz, sitting in for John Perry, and we're thinking about cognitive bias. Our guest is Brian Nosek from the University of Virginia.
So, Brian, I want to start by digging into an example and then zoom out and talk about the structure of cognitive biases in general. So let's look at an example in detail. What's the most striking or surprising example of a cognitive bias that you know of?
Well, for me, it's the general form of bias that manifests in what we presume to be the most objective enterprise that humanity is pursuing, which is science, right? Scientists are supposed to be figuring out what the objective truths, to the extent that truths are identifiable, of how the world works. And yet, scientists have many biases in how it is they generate, appreciate, evaluate evidence. And that's because they are part of the system. Science is done by scientists, and they can't help but use their own limits of human reasoning in trying to discover what's real.
So are scientists subject to cognitive biases that the rest of us, just the cognitive biases that the rest of us are, because they're human, all too human, as Nietzsche would say? Or does the science have its own kind of built-in biases that are special to science?
Well, the biases are the same, but the way they manifest is somewhat different because of some of the unique structures of science.
So give me an example. Science,
yeah. So in science, for me to get a job, for me to keep my job, for me to advance in my career, the currency is publication. I need to publish as frequently as I can and in the most prestigious outlets that I can. And so to do that, I have to get findings that are publishable. And in science, not everything gets published. I study lots of things. Some of that gets written up into reports, and then some of that gets reviewed by my peers, and some of that gets through that peer review process and into a publication. And so the way in which biases like hindsight bias and confirmation bias and familiarity biases like the ones you mentioned already, the way those manifest are me reasoning about my findings as I obtain them and then prettying them up in order to be more publishable, to get the rewards that I need to survive in science.
So that does make it seem like the structure of incentives doesn't align well in the light of our biases with generating truth. So I'm wondering what you think about things like, the discouragement of replication, because trying to do replications doesn't win you a Nobel Prize. There's no Nobel Prize for replications. It's for original work. There's no Nobel Prize for proving a null hypothesis. And you can't get published in journals for doing things like that.
Right. Yeah, that's a key point. So what are the core incentives of what kinds of results are better results, right? Better results are novel results. Better results are positive. You find a relationship or find an impact rather than saying nothing to see here. And clean and tidy results are better than results that have exceptions and messes and things that don't make sense.
Wait a minute. Nothing to see here. I mean, what if Brian Nosek had done some amazing work that everybody thought was amazing work, and Ken Taylor came along and said, actually, nothing to see here? Wouldn't Ken Taylor get some notoriety by challenging kind of received wisdom and showing that Brian Nosek hadn't delivered the goods? Why not?
There can be a little bit of benefit from that, of trying to challenge conventional wisdom if it's compelling, but it's a real uphill climb. And you can also think about that in reverse. If you had first said, nothing to see here, about some new phenomenon that you were studying, everyone had said, well, yeah, so what?
Yeah.
But then if I later come along and say, actually, there is something, then I'm the one that gets the fame, and you're the one that just couldn't do it.
So I mean, I can see ways that we could tinker with the incentive system by, like, founding and supporting journals that publish replications or that give weight to people who prove null hypotheses that there's nothing here. But what can we do in ordinary life? I can't, you know, if I'm biased, there's no journal that's going to pick up and replicate my biases.
Yeah.
We don't want somebody following me around and trying to replicate.
That's right. So the journals is sort of an add-on solution in the process of trying to deal with biases. But really, science has a different way of handling these biases that does apply across human endeavors. And one of those is transparency, right? In order for a scientific claim to become credible, you have to show how it is you arrived at that claim. Here's the evidence that I generated. Here's the way I analyzed it. Here's my interpretation. And if I don't show you that, then the community will be more suspicious of that claim.
So look, that's good. And we're going to talk about how to cope and ameliorate our cognitive biases a lot in the last part of our conversation with you. But I want to kind of rub our nose in the fact of it a little bit more, because I want to think about where these biases come from. Deborah said evolution doesn't do junk. So if you look at these biases from an evolutionary perspective, from kind of a design perspective, I mean, they sound like bugs, but if you look at them from a design perspective, they might look like features. Do you buy that thought, that actually some of these cognitive biases are adaptive features of our mind rather than sort of maladaptive bugs of our mind? What do you think about that thought?
Yeah, in fact, I insist on it. So this is really the core, I think, of understanding something about cognitive bias, which is that it's rooted in very ordinary operations of the mind that usually serve us very well. The times where it leads us astray are very notable and noticeable and often are things that we want to correct and do something about. But most of the time, these heuristics are making the world a lot easier for us to deal with.
So give me an example. Give me an example of something that, from looked at in one way, from this kind of design perspective, looks like a feature, but looked at another way, or maybe taken out of context, it looks more like a bug. Can you give me a concrete example?
Sure. So confirmation bias, one of the most pervasive biases, right? The basic idea of confirmation bias is I'll look for information consistent with my current view of the world, and I'll be more likely to take that seriously because it reaffirms what I think I already know. You know, we can see the problem of that in a world where there's lots of competing information and some of it is false. You know, the political world of today, confirmation bias leads to lots of polarization. Okay, there's all the bad. What's the good of confirmation bias? Well, the good of confirmation bias is if I have a solution that works, keep doing it, right? As soon as I figure out this is a way that I can get food and I need to get food to survive, great. I'm going to do that again and again and again and again. I don't need to search for the exceptions because I don't need to waste my time with that. It's only when I'm confronted with when it doesn't work that I will then search for new information.
So, Deborah,
it's a simplifying process.
Deborah, you want to
get in there? It seems to me that there's some, so you're mentioning a core problem that biases help us address, right? There's too much information and we need to find a way to pick out what's salient. So that's, you know, one core problem. Another core problem might be that sometimes we have to act very quickly in the face of uncertainty. And so we've got to jump to conclusions, and a bunch of biases help us do that. Are those the two main core problems? Are there other core problems that biases help us address? Since, you know, some biases go, you know, make us go really wrong, especially in a world of interdependent, cooperative, diverse people.
Yeah. So quick decision making is a big one. And that's a very useful to have a heuristic, because instead of having to think through the entire problem, you can say, no, run. That thing with big teeth, run. Doesn't matter if, and later I find out, oh, it actually was a fake thing. Well, that's not a big deal. I at least saved myself.
You're pointing out something really important, just because I think this is really central. Because if you're thinking about it in a design way, design a mind that can survive in a world, there are the cost of false positives and the cost of false negatives. And sometimes the cost of a false negative, oh, that's not a tiger, and you ran, well, that's no big deal, right? But if you think that is a tiger, or something.
Yeah. Exactly. And so we don't often, in deciding the extent to which something is a bias, we don't often consider the unobserved, the unknowns of what if it hadn't happened, or the false negative side. Another example of one of these sort of general things that biases can help with is resolving ambiguity, right? So yeah, there's a lot of information that's hard to parse, but often the information itself is incomplete. And so we have to do something to fill in the gaps, to impose some interpretation in order to do anything, because we just don't have enough.
Mm-hmm.
So what do we use to fill in the gaps? That inductive process of deciding, well, I need to do something now. Is it safe or is it not safe? Well, I'm going to use some of my past experience, my assumptions, my beliefs about things that are sort of like this in order to help me go to do the next thing.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about cognitive bias with Brian Nosek, and Cynthia from San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Cynthia. What's your comment or question?
My question is there research on bias differences in gender? And if there is, what are some of the salient points?
So, Brian, that's a question for you, definitely. So, are there differences in gender in this stuff?
Yeah, so it's a very interesting question. And on the general idea of are men or women more or less biased, most of the evidence suggests there is not a gender difference. Men and women are susceptible to the same kinds of cognitive biases in reasoning and judgment and decision making. Now, of course, there are situations where you might predict that it would manifest a little bit differently depending on differences in prior experiences or culture or otherwise.
So wait a minute.
Those
what about
seem
this
to be
one?
Local.
Brian, what about this one? I read recently that men are evolved to overestimate women's signals of sexual availability, and that's an evolutionarily stable strategy. And women aren't in the same way evolved. Something about women are more attuned by evolution to the reality of commitment among males, whether males are willing to commit long term. So there's a difference in the way men and women suss each other out. Is that true, there's a difference.
Yeah, I mean, you're blowing my mind on this because you're explaining my entire dating histories all of a sudden.
Exactly.
That all makes sense to me.
Right.
So the
argument goes, for a male, the cost of being wrong about a woman's ovals is negligible, right? Because if you always assume, well, given any sign of sexual attraction, pursue that woman. Right. Well, then you'll end up pursuing lots of women. Then lots of women will rebuff you, but big deal. But if you don't do that, then you won't get opportunities to mate. But for women, what matters, according to the evolutionary strategy, is, you know, that the male will be around, so they need to be attuned to levels of commitment. I know some feminists and
yeah,
you
I was
going
to say,
stuff.
I think we have to be a little skeptical of these evolutionary explanations for everything, since a lot of biases look like they're filtered through incentive structures and institutions, just like we were talking about in the case of science. There are things we can do that can white out, so to speak, bias. And I always worry about these, you know, evolutionary stories about, you know, why women wear high-heeled shoes
to signal to men
that they're not going to run away.
So what do you think of these evolutionary? I mean, a lot of this design thinking is evolutionary design thinking. So what do you think about those as a general cat? I hear some skepticism in Deborah's voice, and I know lots of other people have that kind of skepticism. So what do you think?
Yeah, I think the skepticism is very fair because with anything that you observe in today's culture, you can generate an interesting functional story for why that would have evolved. We're just fantastic at generating narratives of explanations. We might call that a narrative bias. I don't know. Let's make up a new term. If that hasn't been used, I've just cleaned it.
There is a Nosek bias.
Yes, finally.
The Nosek narrative bias.
I have arrived. It's so easy to generate narratives for anything. I mean, we could play it as a game. Like, observe a difference between men and women and generate a causal story that has an evolutionary history for it, right? Wearing pink versus wearing blue, right? I bet we could generate a story, and then we would find information that in the 1860s, actually those color gender codes were reversed. Men were more likely associated with pink. Oh no, that ruins our evolutionary story. So it's very hard to get good evidence about evolutionary stories.
That's definitely true. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about cognitive bias with Brian Nosek. Ariane from San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ariane.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Just to continue that understanding about the subjectivity of stories and our own personal perspectives, they've done studies that show that people are generally more empathic with people who are similar to them. And recognizing that, I think it's really important to understand how powerful and important ethnic studies programs truly are and why they're being strategically defunded. And also, not only that, that we it behooves us to offer other classes, like even in high school as well, like anthropology that shows the subjectivity of our culture and our often our historical points of view in relationship to other more vulnerable countries and other people that have less power than ourselves. So I just really encourage that. I think preschool teachers know that at circle time. They invite children's cooperation and understanding of different perspectives, but it shouldn't end there. We really need to include it in our public education system in terms of regular required class time. That's my thought.
I think that's a really good point. And in fact, I've been wondering, after being exposed to all these biases, why we don't teach about this earlier on, because we are mostly unaware of our biases. Yeah. And why aren't students in high school or junior high school exposed to those biases?
That's a good question, Brian. I want to give you a chance to answer, but I want to add on something, though, because you guys are having the optimistic side that somehow being exposed to the fact of them will make us change them. Maybe not. But some of them actually do rather seem to be hardwired into the architecture of the brain and just wanting to change them, or even saying having a determination to change them, doesn't automatically make them go away. So before we go to the break, you want to comment on that whole stream that we just had there, Brian?
Well, you took what seemed to be an answerable question and turned it into a multi-part, highly hard-to-answer question.
Yeah.
But that's okay. These are the big things. And I thought the caller's point was very good, is that a lot of what cultural studies types of courses can do is expose people to the assumptions that they have based on the cultural context that they're in. And that can be very useful as an awareness-raising device. But I think your point is very good as well, which is awareness, it may be necessary, but it isn't sufficient to deal with a lot of these cognitive biases. And perhaps we can unpack that further.
So I have a question about that going to this, which is just, does it help to have diverse people in the room when you're discussing or talking about cognitive biases? Does that help?
It depends. So the diversity on its own doesn't necessarily address any particular bias if everyone actually shares that same bias. So, for example, my colleagues Sophie Trewalter and Kelly Brownell have done research on pain management of African-American versus white patients by doctors and nurses and otherwise. How much pain medication do they give when people are complaining of pain? And they have not found any differences in by gender, by ethnicity of the doctors in their pain medication administration to black and white patients. And there's always a bias, right? White patients get more pain medication for the same level of reported pain as compared to black patients.
So, you know, you gave the answer that is one of the five laws of social science. It depends. But after a break, we'll take
yeah,
more.
Right.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about cognitive bias with Brian Nosek from the University of Virginia.
In our final segment, we'll think about strategies for debiasing the mind. Are attention and focus enough? Or do we need strategies that rely on external aids, as in the example of blinding papers for review?
Debiasing the mind, when Philosophy Talk continues. With so many unconscious biases infecting our cognition, does anyone ever really see the real you? I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that unbiasedly questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Deborah Satz, sitting in for John Perry. Our guest is Brian Nosek from the University of Virginia, and we're thinking about cognitive bias.
So, Brian, I got kind of a two-part question for you. We can take them one part at a time. I'll tell you the two parts, but let's take them one part at a time. First of all, I want to go back to this awareness thing. How do we become aware of our cognitive bias? And I don't mean just in general, but how do I become aware of them operating in me now? Or can I ever do that? Second, to what extent is recognizing them and then trying to overcome them helpful in debiasing our mind? So let's take that first thing about how do I become more aware?
This is a super hard problem because we don't observe our mental operations. We only experience their output. So if those processes that are happening behind the scenes that are helping me with deciding what's happening in the world are influenced by biases, I can't look inside my mind and see that happening. And so it's very hard to recognize our own biases. Emily Pronin has called this the bias blind spot. We can see biases in others more easily than we can see them in ourselves. Because we have such confidence in our own experience of our own reasoning compared to what we see in the behaviors of others and why they might be doing that.
But why think of this?
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, why think of this as an individual project, you know, that I am doing this on my own? So that's why in the last segment when we were talking about can it help to bring other people into a conversation? So you had given the example that doctors are biased about the pain medication prescriptions for black and white patients. But what if some of those black patients were sitting in the room?
I get you, Deborah, but that's a kind of like, I'm going to call it a million thought. A million thought in the following way. You know, reasoning on my own, I'm going to believe all kinds of crazy things. Put a bunch of people around me who's going to react to my believing. They're going to press me and push me this way and that. And that's one of the cool tricks of science. It's not an individual solitary undertaking. There is a scientific community that is collectively trying to get at the truth and all these checks and balances, as it were. I think that's really cool. But what if when I get in surrounded by all these people, I think, what? You say this, but you're the one being biased. It could just devolve into the argument of whose biases are, you know, backed by what power?
The biggest. That's right. Right. And so both of these are probably happening, right? So the solution to these biases, right? If I can't depend on my own internal consultation of my mind to identify whether I'm biased, my only solution for getting more awareness of the biases in my own judgment and behavior is to expose them, right? Expose the process of what I'm deciding, how I'm deciding it, to others to critique, right? And so there may be some community evaluation of that. There may be some automated way of identifying those biases. It doesn't depend on other people. It could be some other process, some watching my behaviors. And simultaneously, that can lead to retrenchment, right? So I can get all these biases once out in the public sphere can lead me to look at the other people that agree with me and say, well, they're, of course, the ones that are not biased because they agree with me. Mm-hmm. And those other people that tell me I'm wrong, well, they're the wrong ones. And that's where we are.
So this episode is one in a series on intellectual humility. And it sounds to me like you're in a way suggesting, you know, surrounding yourself with other people it looks like a good thing, but one of the requirements for benefiting from that is to have a kind of degree of intellectual humility, a degree in the belief in your own fallibility when confronted with this stuff. Oh, confirmation, but I don't suffer from that, right? When confronted with all the fact of biased human cognition, to ask yourself, gee, am I just being biased here?
Right. Of course, too much deference to others is itself a kind of bias.
That's right.
Go with the crowd, you know,
that's
conform.
That's why this pathway of finding the right degree of intellectual humility is a hard pathway. Yeah. Can psychology help? Can your field help us with that? I mean, philosophy is obsessed with this question. Can psychology help us with that?
Yeah, I think so. And just to amplify your point, I think the biggest danger in cognitive bias is overconfidence. It's that sense that I must be correct in some way or another, or overestimate the likelihood that I'm correct based on my own internal experience. And so for me, the core of the part relating to intellectual humility from all of this research on cognitive bias is that if I want to behave in a way that's aligned with my values, which is what I think most people want to do, then instead of feeling like the way to do that is through pure intention and will, right? I just have to overcome my biases by a matter of wanting to be a good person and do it justly. Instead, my best strategy is to expose my process so that others can identify when I'm being biased. And the humility aspect of it is to not see someone saying, wait a second, why did you decide that? Or here's a way you might have been wrong. Instead of taking that as an attack, take it as an opportunity. Because the identification of bias, if there is something influencing my behavior that's moving me differently than my values, then I should be saying thank you to someone that identifies the bias.
But this has got to be not just an individual achievement. The humility has to also be a feature of groups, because it's very dangerous for individuals to be humbled in a culture in which groups feel emboldened think that they are in possession of the truth, because then you get conformity and groupthink and kinds of bad outcomes.
And that's what Mill worried deeply about, right? That's the thing that Mill worried very deeply about. But I want to shift this just a little bit. I mean, I think this is a really deep point that you guys are honing in on. But I want to ask you another point, because, you know, I kind of like that Aristotelian thought that humankind is the rational animal. I kind of like that. But then I think, well, that's a thought made from 10,000 feet above, looking at the actual mechanisms that govern human cognition. And then I think, well, once you get down there in the weeds of the mind, in the weeds of the brain, it really does look like kind of a mess. Right. It really does look like there are some truth tracking processes, and then some people distinguish between system one and system two. System one is the quick and dirty, unreliable stuff that works in situ. System two is the kind of slow, deliberative thing, and the mind has both of them. I'm not sure there's a neat divide. I wonder if you think that if you get down into the weeds of the mind with people like you, I mean, does it look like we vindicate the Aristotelian thought that humankind is the rational animal, or what?
In the scrum of the mind, rationality is in the exception rather than the rule, right? We are just dealing with the information that we have and doing the best we can. That doesn't mean humans can't think rationally. They can. It's just the question is, do they, and under what conditions do they? And I think most of that ideal is something that emerges eventually, not in the mix of the decisions in the moment, but rather the cumulative process of trying to come to what is really going on here.
We've got time for one last caller, Hakeem from Castro Valley. What's your comment or question quickly here?
Good morning to everyone. I'm going to say this. The human mind has been constructed and designed to follow truth. Everything is based on truth and lies. The human being is the only creature on this earth that can lie to itself. So if you don't follow truth, if the human mind does not follow truth, it's going to be taken out of its natural form and put, and then it would be seeing things in a false form. You're never going to catch a bee trying to be an ant, and you're never going to catch an ant trying to be a bee. So it's based on truth, and that's what he said from the very beginning of his conversation. It's based on truth. That's all I have to say.
So thanks for that, Hakeem. What do you think about that, Brian?
Yeah, it's an interesting point, and it makes me think of a really interesting paper that someone, a pair of folks wrote in the last couple of years, which is what's the purpose of reasoning? We think the purpose of reasoning naturally is to get to the truth. They said, nope, that's not it. The purpose of reasoning is to win arguments, that it's a social process, that we didn't evolve reasoning to get to truth. So they're sort of disagreeing with the caller's point that in fact we use reasoning in order to win arguments.
If that was the point, there are better ways to win arguments, which is
power.
Sticks. Reason seems like it's on to something more than that.
Yeah, and it's not.
This sounds like philosopher defensiveness to me.
But it's not. If we were only surrounded by other human beings, and our only task was to like went out over them, but we're surrounded and embedded in a world that is a certain way, and to thrive in that world, we can't believe that the cup is to my left when it's to my right. We've got to have there's got to be some
truth tracking,
don't you think?
Yeah,
and that's got to be at the core of it.
Yeah, but a lot of that can be accomplished through the perceptual processes of just what's happening in the world. But the extra, these cognitive capacities of deciding what's true, regardless of how I'm behaving in the world, right? The internal dialogue that is then externalized in order to talk to people about what things they think might be there that aren't actually right in front of them. Right, those could have emerged for more social reasons.
So I'm going to ask you one quick question. We're at the end, but something you said: is perception less governed by bias than reasoning, ratiocination? Is perception free of bias? I would think even there may be, because I know there's this looming effect, the perceptual looming effect, for example. So in general, how about perception? How influenced by bias is that?
Perception is filled with biases, and you can experience this just by going onto YouTube and searching cognitive or perceptual illusions and get a whole bunch of them. These emerge because of the very hard problem of there's a world out there and there's the experience of the world in my brain. How does my brain get that world out there into some sort of internal experience? Well, it has our sensory systems, and that translates that world out there into these electrical chemical signals that are sent to our brain through our various organs for sensation, right? Eyes and taste and hearing and everything else. And then that experience of the world out there is constructed. It's constructed based on that stuff coming in, and interpretation is imposed on that stuff coming in.
Right,
that
Brian,
fills in the gaps, that has all the ambiguous, everything else.
So that's going to have to be the last word. This is a fascinating conversation. I could go on. We could go on for hours, but I got to say goodbye to you. So thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Our guest has been Brian Nosek. He's a professor of psychology from the University of Virginia, co-founder and director of the Center for Open Science. This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is, get this, cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in that community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now, here's a guy who forms his biases fast. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, it's hard to get worked up about cognitive biases because everybody seems to be not fighting against them, not climbing our slow way back to sensibleness. Well-thought-out bullet points, columns pro and con on an issue, pipe-smoking, beard-stroking, forelock-tugging, mansplaining, exploring the ramifications, the consequences, the manly and womanly art of thinking things through is gone. It's all tainted. We call them short-term ramifications. That's cognitive bias. Long-term ramifications. Who decides these terms? Now we either aggressively pursue or tentatively reach out for the cognitive bias that is right for us. It's all about the rhetoric, not the reasoning. Who's in the room, not what's being said. And descriptions vary. People who supported Obama were sometimes called jackbooted thugs. Not even thugs with sensible shoes. People who supported Hillary were Democratic operatives. Operatives, that's like a secret spy. Some claim that we're living in a Trump era. Others insist day after day that this isn't normal. And others accuse the media of normalizing this era of ours, which may or may not be Trump. No wonder we're confused, divided, irrational. Nowhere is this more apparent than in the term fake news. I'm old enough to remember when news was said to have a liberal bias. Now it's fake, which doesn't make any sense. I mean, news is real. If a truck goes off a bridge, for example, and you report it, that's not fake news. You can portray a bias, I suppose, by demanding that truck drivers be taken off the streets. Or we should all switch over to Uber so this sort of thing will never happen again. Or develop flying cars, get rid of trains, shrink humans, and put them on drones to get them to the jobs that don't exist anymore without gridlock. But that's all propaganda or wishful thinking or public relations or blinkered belief systems. But the news itself is not fake. It's what we do with it. If we just sip the beer instead of chugging a 12-pack, we'd all be better off. But we are faced today with two conflicting events. We immediately go for the binary of one is good, one is bad, one is true, one is false, based on nothing more than our preconceptions. I'm thinking now of when our President Trump said that Mika from the Morning Joe show on MSNBC, which has been critical of him, said she wanted to come to his party, but he said no because she was bleeding from a facelift and he thought it was yucky. Cognitive bias and all, what a stupid, rude lie. And I think we can also agree that on its face, that's a pretty creepy public statement from a world leader. And aside from his minions, who seemed to think he was defending himself from a full frontal assault by Mongol hordes or something, most people agreed. But they also seemed to think this is some kind of attack on journalism, rather than a kind of stunt previously confined to professional wrestling. Is Morning Joe journalism, though? I think it's one of those morning chat shows where senators and congressmen drop by to bloviate discreetly, with only occasional interference or interruption. No bombshells are dropped as a rule. No resignations submitted after an appearance in the Morning Joe. Trump is an ass. Joe and Mika are lunkhead suck-ups in a corrupt medium. Both of these things could be true. We can hold both these hots at the same time without our heads exploding. A whopping 40% of Americans agree with me. Or is that a depressing 40% agree with me? Glass is half full, I guess, or half empty. It's just a glass with some water in it. Who cares? I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, local public radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2017.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin.
Our senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Audrey Dilling, and Colin Peden.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
You didn't just break up.
Hey, it's been like 3 weeks.
You slept with somebody 3 hours after you thought you broke up. I mean, bullets have left guns slower.